Vermont Viewpoint is a public affairs program produced and funded by WDEV and the Radio Vermont Group. We welcome listener feedback. Email your comments to vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com.
Good morning. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV. I'm Rick Singeri. Okay, here's what we've got going today. First hour dedicated to beer. We'll meet one of the new brewers in the state to start off with, and then we'll talk to a Vermont hop grower who actually supplies our brewer with some of what he uses in his beer. At 10, we'll open up the phones for the first time this week, and then we'll talk about some of the legislation approved this past session that affect our farmers and our food producers. Now we head to St. Johnsbury to meet the owner of the best brewery name in the state. Jeffrey Sawalki of Whirligig Brewing joins us now. Jeff, welcome to Vermont Viewpoint.
Thank you, Rick. It's great to be here.
Nice to have you. Listeners, if you'd like to ask Jeff about Whirligig, or if you've been lucky enough to sample their wares, you can call us. 244-1777, toll-free 877-291-TALK. That's 877-291-8255. You can also email vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. Got to ask Jeff, what exactly is a Whirligig?
A Whirligig is actually a colloquial term used in some parts of Vermont and other parts of New England to describe the Samara seed, which is that helicopter seed that comes from the maple tree.
Okay, good. How did you choose that as a name for your brewery?
That's kind of funny. So I had originally thought that we were going to open our brewery in our shed, our barn, in our backyard, but that kind of got mixed when I sort of got into the regulatory challenges of doing that. So we looked for a place in downtown St. Johnsbury. And at the time, I had been thinking about Post and Beam, and the space we ended up using is more modern. So that was kind of next. Also, another brewery in New Hampshire had taken that name. So I had to look for another sort of name that spoke to Vermont.
And Whirligig it was. It really is catching. Why did you decide to start your own brewery, Jeff?
So I guess it's two parts. I'd always have a long, lifelong sort of passion around food and drink. One time I decided I was going to cook everything, but it couldn't come from a box or a can. So as you can imagine, making things like pasta and sitting and watching and waiting was a long process. So I always thought that I'd get into food and drink. The other half is before I got into this brewing thing, I was a community and economic development field specialist over at the University of New Hampshire, and my whole job was engaging with communities and encouraging them to follow their passions and to really take ownership over their community. So, you know, I kind of followed my own advice and decided to open Whirligig Brewing.
And why in St. Jay?
So my wife is from Waterford, which for your listeners who know, it's right next door to St. Johnsbury. Mm-hmm. She went to the St. Johnsbury Academy. Her family has roots here. I'm not from here, but, you know, we wanted to raise our kids around dirt and trees, so we moved to Vermont. And so this is a community where we spend a lot of our time. It's sort of the hub of where we live. We're actually living in Peacham, so we decided to open the brewery here.
Oh, that's beautiful. Now, what does it take, Jeff, to get a microbrewery started and off the ground?
Well, hopefully, first you know how to brew a little bit of beer.
Yeah.
Though I guess you could hire someone, too, but then that's an extra cost. I think it's really about a dedication and passion to checking all the boxes. You know, home brewing is one thing. Once you get into doing it professionally, there are a lot of regulatory things you need to consider. I mean, I think like 90% of what I do is checking off boxes and filling out forms for everything I do. But if you can get beyond that, and, you know, I actually went to Vermont Law School, so the legal compliance thing is not new to me, you can totally do this. If you have the passion for it, I would totally encourage you to go out and start your own brewery.
So when did the brewery officially launch?
Oh, so I actually opened right into the pandemic.
Ah,
so
there you go. Well done.
June of last year.
Yeah. And so, how has that affected getting up and running?
It's been a wild ride. So when I opened, obviously we couldn't let folks into the brewery. We're all masking up. It was all to go on a miniature little can seamer. And since then, we've had, you know, fits and starts. And now we're fully open, hopefully, for a while. I mean, this Delta variant gives me worries. But, you know, take it as we can, one step at a time.
Now, I understand that because of the pandemic, you've had to pick up some other work. What else have you been doing?
So I actually have a part-time job at the town of Hardwick as their community development coordinator. It's sort of, you know, something that I had been doing before I decided to take the leap as a small business owner, except this time instead of encouraging communities to do what they want to do, I actually wrote the grants to help them do it. So that's what I do to fill my back time.
And then how much time does that allow you at the brewery itself?
Well, luckily, I took a partial hiatus from that position. I'll be going back in the fall. I put in a few hours a week, mostly to take notes and whatnot. But it took a good percent, but in the winter, because we had shut down the tap room and I was only selling to go, I was able to backfill my time writing grants.
Now, tell us about your brewing philosophy and the style of beers that you brew there at Whirligig.
Yeah, so I haven't been brewing that long, so I haven't been ingrained into any sort of process that would, you know, mentally limit me from going outside of a particular style or type of beer that I like to brew. I also like to brew different things all the time. So if you come into my tap room, you'll see an ever-changing list of beers. As a Main Street brewery, I brew all sorts of beer, from lager to IPAs to stouts. But my focus is in sour beer and in wild fermentation.
And explain that, both of those, sour beers and wild fermentation, for people who haven't really dabbled in that yet.
Yeah, so I would say sour beer is more akin to wine. Before I started brewing, my wife and I were really into drinking wine. Once I picked up a homebrew kit that my mom got me for a birthday, I really got into beer, but my palate had already developed around wine. And for those listeners who've had wine, you can often get notes of acidity in your wine. And I find it's a wonderful accompaniment to food, to cleansing your palate, to drinking with friends. And so I wanted to take that into brewing. And I know that it had been done before. And, you know, originally most beer was probably sour because they didn't have clean yeast to use. But a little bit of acidity, I think, helps clean the palate and can add a new sort of angle to your beer. Wild fermentation is where, instead of using a lab yeast, which is what we mostly use, a clean yeast that's created in the lab, well, not necessarily created, but cultivated in the lab. We use yeast and bacteria that are within the natural environment. In my case, what exists within a barrel, an oak barrel. So we don't put anything in. We just put the wort, the sugar juice, into the barrel, and then it ferments on its own.
Interesting. I always wondered how that was accomplished. So thanks for that explanation. I know you try to use local hops and malts, and later this morning we're actually going to be speaking with Kevin Broderick of Whitefield Hop Yard, who is one of your suppliers. Why is this important for the beers that you brew?
So I think it really harkens back to my whole idea around community economic development, encouraging communities to take ownership over their own place and revitalization. The more money we spend and can keep within our communities, the more money that is circulated within our neighbors and our colleagues and our friends and family. So in that sense, focusing on sourcing as much local as I can, you know, there are things that I can't do that or that are just too prohibitively expensive. But for those things that I can, such as malt and hops, I try to do that as much as possible. There are exceptions. I think IPAs are really tough. I know that Champlain Hop Yard is working on a project with other brewers to identify great uses for local hops. I use Whitefield Hop Yard as well as Champlain Hops, Valley Hops, in my beers, but IPAs are a little tough. I mostly use for IPAs I usually only keep one on the menu, conventional hops that are grown on the West Coast. But I'm trying to move the marker more towards New England by using Michigan hops. But that said, I use, malt probably makes up 99% of what you use besides water. So I use that exclusively for the most part.
All right. And when 7 Days wrote about Whirligig, they said that you don't have a signature beer. So usually a brewery or a cidery, a winery, has a real kind of forward, signature beer that people come to know, and then they'll try the others. We think of The Alchemist and Heady Topper. So how is that possible, and why have you decided to keep rotating beers that you brew instead of having, like, a real signature beer?
I think it's probably my personality and the way that I treat my kitchen. So before I brew beer, I would come into the kitchen and think about a concept of what I wanted to cook for the day or for that evening, and then I would, go about and execute it. Sometimes there were failures, and sometimes they were, mind-blowing, I would hope. At least to me, they might have been. But that's the same thing I take with beers. You don't discover something new unless you step outside the lines. So by being more malleable in how I go about my brew day, it gives the customer that opportunity to try something new and experience something that might not have been done before, or at least something that they have not had before. For me, it makes my job more fun and engaging because it's not like I have to go in and brew again the same beer again and again. I do have some beers that I repeat because they are customer favorites.
That's what I wondered.
Yeah.
What are those?
For the most part, I keep those, So one of them is a coffee milk stout that I do. A lot of coffee milk stouts are often very vanilla sugar forward. I work with a local coffee roaster, Roasted, from East Burke. Todd, we went through 7 different beans to identify the right roast level and the right sort of bean to make a coffee stout that really tastes like coffee and stout. Mm. I also brew a Pilsner-style lager that I keep on hand for those that want a lager. And I've started to brew a New England-style IPA that I feel really fits sort of the textures that I produce. It's more light and sessionable, but I think it definitely fits sort of that New England IPA style. And then there's a number of sours that I rebrew because they're customer favorites.
Let's go to the phones. We've got Forbes. Hi, Forbes. Go right ahead.
Hi, how are you?
Great. How are you doing?
Talking about a flourishing industry. This is it.
Yes,
definitely.
Indeed.
My son is a brewmaster in Barrington, New Hampshire, but he cut his teeth at Long Trail. Mm. That's where he learned the business. And brewmasters are kind of interesting. It's kind of like a unique club. They seem to all know each other and correspond and swap stories and whatnot.
Yeah.
But raw material, is such as the hops and the barleys and various other things, is really lagging behind for what the need is here. Especially, it's a great opportunity in Vermont.
Absolutely.
And he was telling me that women actually created the movement. Before, they basically didn't like beer, but the only beer they drank was Miller High Life. And then when the microbreweries started to come out, changed the whole flavor and texture, and women started to drink beer.
Wow.
They really put it over the top.
Forbes, some great points, and I'd love to put these to Jeff Sawalki. Jeff, what do you learn from other brewmasters, first of all? And have you seen a lot of women coming into your tasting room and fueling, what you're doing there?
Yeah, I think to the first part, since I'm new, I don't know many breweries and brewmasters, but the ones that I have met, we share a lot of questions and feedback. We shoot the breeze to solve some of our challenges. Some of them around canning, other ones around, how do we get supplies? The list goes on. It's really great. Once I started this business up, reaching out to other breweries doesn't feel like a challenge. Though sometimes talking to some of these folks, it feels like I'm talking to, your hero or whatnot, and that can be a little bit, challenging for me, but it's really awesome to be a part of this community.
And then,
I guess to women brewing or to women coming into the brewery, it's wonderful to see a great diversity of folks from all spectrums in here, and from a demographic, I guess, numbers game. From what I've heard, and you can back check me on this, but sour beer, I guess, finds a higher number of female drinkers than other types of beer. So that would be my two cents on that part.
All right. And, you know, Jeff, on the website Untappd, several of your sours really seem to be among your most popular. So tell us about some of the sours that you do offer.
Yeah, so I guess I don't read Untappd because I don't want to get into the long, deep hole of people reviewing my beer.
I understand. It's a smart choice.
Difficult. But, for example, I recently brewed this beer called Chamomile and Jasmine. I recently submitted it to the Great American Beer Festival for competition. I think it's a unique sour. It's definitely an American sour, meaning it's a higher acidity level with a sort of a Pilsner-style malt bill, so lighter on the palate. But I use chamomile and jasmine in the process, and those bring a sort of a light floral apple note to the beer, as well as some tannins, which dry the palate and elevate sort of that cleanly or clean mouthfeel when you finish your sip. I think it's really great. Some people think it's exceptional. But it's definitely unique in the very least. I also do a Gosa style beer, a German, traditional German beer done with salt and coriander. Traditionally, the German style, which is Reinheitsgebot, which is the taxing rule around beer, it sort of steps outside of that rule because it was a traditional beer using wheat as well as coriander and salt. But it's slightly savory. Some people say that this version that I brew is more akin to wine. It's not super acidic. It's also not that saline, but it's definitely unique among the Gosa style.
Do you have a personal favorite of the beers you're brewing right now?
Yeah, I think my favorite is probably Amarillo Gosa. It's that Gosa style, but then I dry hop it with Amarillo, which is a hop common used in IPAs. But when I use it in this style of beer, it presents like white grape notes, very wine-like, really refreshing and unique.
I was in St. Jay on Christmas Eve and tried to stop by your place, but you weren't open. Tried to pick up beer, you know, locally, couldn't find yours. So are your beers only available at the tasting room right now, or are they being canned or bottled and are available elsewhere?
So right now I do can and bottle my beer as well as have glasses available in the tap room. However, they're not yet available for distribution, but I'm currently in the process of working on that. I'll let you know more once I sign the paperwork. But
all right. Well, let's talk about the tap room then. When is it usually open when people can stop by and pick some up?
Yeah, definitely. Thursdays through Sundays. Fridays we're open from 2 to 7. Friday and Saturday we're open from 11 to 7. And Sunday we're open from 2 to 7.
All right, sounds good. And then what's it like coming to your tap room?
Well, I hope it's it feels like a nice step away into a new environment. We're really focused on making our patrons comfortable in the space that we have. We actually have an artist gallery featuring Harlan Mack, who is from Johnson, Vermont. He has some really interesting artwork. I guess he classifies it as Afrofuturism. It's really cool, really dynamic. We're really blessed to have him in our taproom. But he really sets the stage, that sort of environment that when you walk in the taproom, it feels really cool and nice. So, yeah.
Is food available?
Yes, food is available. So we actually work with a food vendor, Wandering Vine, Sarah Spence, and she puts a wonderful sort of list of eclectic foods on the menu. She also does a prefix Indian-inspired dinner on Fridays. So come in and try something different outside the box.
All right. You have about a minute left to entice us with another beer. How about Floating Helicopters?
Floating helicopters, that was an IPA I did a while ago. Definitely one of my first sort of ventures into the IPA world, but I try to keep a light on the palate, not too bitter forward, but definitely try to focus on those fruity notes from the hops, as well as the yeast I use, which is a Kivik farmhouse yeast from Norway.
And how about one more you want to tempt us with, Jeff?
One more. I guess right now I would say come in for that chamomile and jasmine before I kick the keg. It's really interesting. It's really yummy. I also have a local strawberry saison. I know strawberries are pretty popular with brewers right now, but this one is definitely tastes like you just bit into a fresh local strawberry.
Oh, I love it. Jeffrey Sawalki is the owner of Whirligig Brewing in St. Johnsbury. To learn more, you can visit whirligigbrewing.square.site. Jeff, thanks so much for being on the program this morning.
Thanks so much, Rick.
All right, take care. We've got a CBS News update, and then we're going to talk to one of the people growing some of the hops being used at Whirligig. And coming up today at 1:10 on WDEV, it's the Sox making up for last night's rainout with the Blue Jays, and game time is 2:10. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV.
Let our staff at the Warren Store ease you back into a pre-pandemic lifestyle. We can cater your postponed events and even bake you a custom cake. We can dress you in comfortable casual clothing. Make it a day trip for the best one-stop shopping in Vermont. Have lunch on our deck, head upstairs for some much-needed retail therapy, then treat yourself to a specialty coffee from our new espresso machine. You can pick up a colorful Warren Store beach towel for a dip in the river, and how about a delicious house-made ice cream sandwich? Fun, funky, safe, and friendly. Warren Store, Main Street, Warren Village, and warrenstore.com.
Welcome back to Vermont Viewpoint. I'm Rick Singeri. Vermont brewers and Vermont beer drinkers love the hops. But for a long time, just about all the hops used in our incredible IPAs and brilliant beers, splendid ciders, came from away. Yes, folks, Flatlander hops. Sorry to break it to you. But there is a tradition of hop growing in this state, and several people have rediscovered the fine art of growing hops here in Vermont. One is nestled in East Hardwick, and it's called Whitefield Hop Yard. Joining us to talk about this lovely, fragrant plant is one of the owners of the yard, Kevin Broderick. Kevin, great to have you on the program this morning.
Hey, thanks for having me, Rick.
Great to have you, Kevin. Listeners, to ask Kevin about growing hops, you can give us a call, 244-1777 or 877-291-8255. You can also email vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. Kevin, what do you and Karen, your wife, do for a living when you're not hop farming?
Yeah, before I go into that, what you were just saying a second ago about, you know, hops being from this area originally, I just wanted to say that the hops that are out west, they really came from here, from New England. The root cuttings went out there when the land opened up and people realized that it was easy to grow hops there and other things. But the original flavor of the hop, as Jeff was saying before, on your show, that, you know, there's a different taste and things, but and hops are very specific to where they're grown. So the taste of hops out west in Yakima Valley, and they have a distinct flavor of that area, or people will call it terroir.
Right.
And as well, hops in Vermont have a very distinct taste and character that you only get here. But the original taste and character was from here. People were used to drinking that flavor in the heyday of hop growing in New England, which would have been the late 1800s and before. I'm sorry, what was the question then? The first question there.
All right. I want to know.
What do we do?
Yeah, what do you do when you're not hop farming?
I am a teacher. I've been teaching for 30-some years. And my wife is a lab, the supervisor at the lab at Copley, and she's been doing that for 30-plus years. So that's what we do. Those are our day jobs.
Two wonderful occupations. So what got you raising hops in the first place?
Well, pa- partly a cheat at school when I was sharing some antique maps with my students of Hardwick. I noticed on one of the maps is an 1875 map of Caledonia County and all the towns, including Hardwick, and it has very few things. It's kind of sparse, but it shows distinct hop yards, large ones. So that kind of got me interested in the history of hops to our area, and from there, there's been many things. I don't know how many what you'd like to hear, but or how much time you have, but a lot of things pointed me towards hops and hop growing. I've always wanted to farm since as long as I can remember. My grandfather asked me when I was a little kid what I wanted to do when I grew up, and I told him I wanted to be a farmer. Mm. And he told me I was going to be a professor, and because I talk too much, and I'm not professoring, but I'm teaching, so it's in that I'm doing both those things now.
Yeah.
we found some writing about Vermont hop farming in the 1800s, the 19th century, in Vermont, by someone named Adam Krakowski. That was fascinating. I was reading journals about people in our area from the early 1800s, which is a period that I'm interested in. And I found some 1830s journal entries by a woman named Abigail Bailey, who lived not far from us, straight down the road. And she was making beer on her hearth right here in East Hardwick. Mm. So I knew they were... they were growing hops, they had the materials, they would grow everything on their own, so the hops must have been growing here then, even that early.
well, Kevin,
I started growing, I started brewing, home brewing myself, and I grew some hop varieties in our garden, my wife's garden, and a friend of mine said you should go up to the hop conference at UVM. I didn't know such a thing existed. And that was fascinating and a huge help to us getting started. So, plus the buzz and excitement around the then new Vermont craft brewing movement was getting our attention as well as other people. We had a little bit of land that was cleared, and I didn't just like mowing it with a lawnmower. I wanted to do something with it. So those things and probably others that I can't think of right now pointed us in the direction of hop growing.
Well, I'm glad they did. What makes Vermont a good place to raise hops?
Well, the hops taste better from here than anywhere else. I mean, the hops are, they're very distinct. They're very, brewers who work with our hops, you can't really approach it the same way you do hops from everywhere else. They're different. And, but we have a lot of great creative brewers out here in the state and who are willing to take a risk and have the skill in order to adjust what they're doing to match the hop profile they're working with. And they have the interest of bringing local flavors to their customers. So hops are if you go, for me, if you go to Vermont and you want, you know, maple syrup, you're not going to be happy if it's coming from, you know, maybe New Hampshire even. Mm-hmm. Nothing wrong with New Hampshire. It's great. But there's times where people, when they come to a place, want to taste things from that place, not just made there. And this gives them a chance to do that. You know, they can taste what the flavor is of this place. And it's specific. It's very good. And it's very special because Vermont, you know, is a very interesting and special place.
Indeed. Well, the hop plant is interesting in itself. How big are they when you plant them, and then how tall will they get when they're fully grown?
The 18 feet is the lines we put up, the strings or ropes we put up for each vine. We put two per hill. So we have about 2,500 some odd strings up in our yard. We're very small compared to out west, and so we are a family-sized farm.
Mm-hmm. And then
so when we first put them in, you know, we're just using root cuttings. So they're just 3 inches of a root cutting that has a couple of eyes on it, you know, like a potato has eyes on it. You look mm-hmm. for ones that have a couple of eyes. You plant them 2 inches down with the eyes facing up as best you can. Depending on the variety, a lot of the conventional varieties, so we grow just a few. We grow Centennial, we grow Cascade, we grow Columbus. And we have this now feral wild hop that's really exciting that we've been growing for several years.
Wow.
So the conventional, I would say, I'll call them conventional hops, the Centennial, the Cascade, and Columbus, it takes a couple years, once you plant them, to get the roots established so you actually get a yield. Our growing season is so short. Out west, they believe you can get it within a year, and even some places in New England, but that are warmer than where we are. Except for the feral wild ones that we have been cultivating that we found growing here. A good friend of ours found some, and we believe might be leftovers from those hop yards in the 1800s that were here.
Oh, my.
Those, I can plant a root cutting that's 3 inches, and by, you know, July, beginning of July, they're at 18 feet, too. So they're unusual in that way, and I think that has something to do with them just being accustomed to the climate and the land here, and they just evolved to thrive. So, but most of the hops, conventional hops that people would be familiar with in Vermont here, when you plant them, it's going to take you 2 years before you get a yield.
Mm-hmm.
And really 3 years for things like Centennial is a little more delicate and shy, so it takes almost 3 years to really get a good yield.
And then how many cones will be on an average hop plant?
Oh, Jesus. It depends. Centennial gets less cones. It depends on the variety. Our Cascade is loaded with cones, and Columbus, too, when it's doing well, is loaded with cones. I don't know how many you'd get, maybe a half a pound dry, if that makes any sense to you. So when we harvest our cones and they're green or wet, they're heavier, and then we dry them down.
Mm.
You know, it takes about 8 hours in our dryer, and then they're much lighter. So when they're dry, per bind, we might get anywhere from a quarter pound to a little more than half a pound per string or bind.
Gotcha.
Does that make sense?
It does. We're completing our hour.
I don't know how to count. I don't know what that would be.
All right. Kevin, harvesting hops, these 18-foot plants have got to be quite a job. How is that done?
Well, in the large hop yards out west, they have these top cutters and bottom cutters, and it's very mechanized. We have to use a tower that I built that goes on the end of my tractor forks, and I stand up on that, and I'm the top cutter. Karen drives the tractor. She mans that and cuts at the bottom. And then we just pull in the hops, the bines, which are, like you're saying, 18 feet. So we drape them over the front of this contraption that I built. And then we bring them over to a harvester. And the harvester was built by a guy who's up New York State, Patrick Comfort, I believe his name is. And it's designed for yards that are 5 acres, it can do about that much. So it works for us. It works really well.
And then once you cut them down, you said the hops are wet. So what happens at your operation there at Whitefield?
When I cut them down?
Yeah.
Bring them over to the harvester. They go through that. That knocks off the cones. It's like a gigantic, I don't know if you've ever seen a chicken plucker that has those kind of metal fingers that knock the feathers off. The bines get pulled through this machine. And it has those sort of plucker fingers on it. They knock the cones and the leaves off the bines. And then it goes through these belts, move all that matter through these fans that separate the leaves from the cones. And then the cones come out one side and the leaves, or the waste you could call it, I guess, what we put back into the compost, goes out the other side.
Mm-hmm.
from there, we take them these totes that hold about 30 pounds of wet hops. We bring those over to this dryer that we have, which is just a large container with fans and dehumidifiers and furnaces in it. And that they go in there on these screens and they dry down for whatever. It depends on the ambient humidity in the air, but it might take 8 hours. It might take more than that. And from a 30-pound tote or so, they dry down to, I think it's probably right around 5 pounds or less when they're dry, to give you a sense of what they are from wet to dry, the same volume. From there, they go into a cooler, and they're stable, and we put them all, so they're dried, and they're nice and light, and they go in these, and we just store them in a large 13 by 15 cooler that we have. For the rest of the harvest season. When harvest is over, then we start milling them.
And when you say milling, are you pelletizing the hops there at Whitefield?
Yeah, most of them. Sometimes we get some people who will buy wet hops.
Mm-hmm.
So those will take right from harvest up to the brewery. Most of our hops are pelletized, so we had to get a large commercial-sized pelletizer. There wasn't one in the state when we started, so we had to make that investment, and that's what we still have. It's large, but it gives us the quality of hops from anywhere else. You can the milling quality is the same as what you would get, or even better, I should say, because I can go slow because we're so small.
Mm.
But it's comparable, at least, to the same kind of pellets brewers would expect from the big wigs out west.
Are you and Karen big IPA fans?
I am more of the IPA person, and Karen has her tastes have evolved, so she is also enjoying IPAs, but she was kind of going along with what Jeff was talking about. She really likes the sour ones.
Mm-hmm.
So, but yeah, I really like everything. I tend to gravitate towards the large IPAs because I just enjoy thinking about what the hops are doing in there.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, as you mentioned, we had Jeffrey from Whirligig Brewing on earlier. He uses your hops. What other breweries are using the hops you grow there in Hardwick?
Well, thankfully, there's been, like I was saying, the brewers were really established by the time we started growing, even though we were one of the early ones, but they took a risk, and we're really thankful for that. So Foam Brewers in the lakefront in Burlington, they really bought the volume in the beginning, and we wouldn't have stayed in business if it hadn't been for them for those first 2 years. So they've been partners with us, really. Mike at Ten Bends in Hyde Park.
Oh, yeah.
It's a great little brewery.
Yep.
People should get over there. It's really a nice, if you're in that area, it's amazing to have that quality of beer right there. Hill Farmstead right here in Greensboro.
Nah.
Rock Art has done some harvest ales with our hops. Jeff at Whirligig in St. Johnsbury.
Yep.
Wondercommer and Craftsbury, a new brewery, very interesting things he offers. People should really check that out. And you can get his beer in different places, but one that comes to mind that's kind of central is that beer, that big craft beer. I think it's called the Beer Cellar in Waterbury.
Mm-hmm.
He's been using some of our Chinook. Oh, I forgot, we have Chinook too. It's a little, not as much as the others, but yeah, and so just the encouragement and support we got from all these people, especially in the beginning and all through it, from the Foam team, Bob, Josh, Todd, and their whole team, really. It's interesting to think that just a little turn of events could mean you get to do something that is life-changing or not,
mm-hmm.
And if it hadn't been for them, this operation, which was definitely life-changing for us, just wouldn't have been able to survive, so we're really thankful for their support and everybody else's.
Well, Kevin, what is it that you really enjoy? What is it that you and Karen enjoy about raising hops?
You get a real sense of place. I mean, your hands are in the soil. And it, something we didn't anticipate was just getting to know all these people I was just talking about.
Yeah.
The brewers, but also the other farmers that we've visited and talked to and shared stories with, and helping each other out. So it's given us a real sense of community and sense of place, which I guess I think everybody needs and wants. It's been great. And everything about it, I also love how specifically right here things change so much. Other farmers would know this, but nothing is the same from month to month. And at the same time, there are these patterns that we follow with the seasons and what's going on. So once you're really exhausted and tired after harvesting for a month and a half, you go to the next phase, which is pelletizing. And from there, you're buttoning up the hop yard so that it's ready for winter.
Mm.
And then before you know it, it's spring. And even when there's still snow on the ground, the shoots will start coming up from the hills in the yard.
Mm-hmm.
So then you're getting ready. You're cleaning up spring. You're getting things. You're getting the irrigation system set. And you go to stringing season, which is, takes us about, I don't know, two to three weeks or so, where we're putting all those, that 2,000 plus strings up, and then training, where you wind the shoots when they get to be about a foot and a half or so. So there's always something new going on. By the time you really get tired of what you're doing, it completely changes and it's the next job. And something about that that I really enjoy.
I love it. Kevin Broderick co-owns Whitefield Hop Yard in East Hardwick with his wife, Karen. Kevin, please keep doing what you're doing, and thanks for being on the show today.
Well, Rick, you're going to have to come out and visit us now.
I can't wait. I can't wait to make my next trip to East Hardwick. We're going to take a break for the top of the hour news, and then we'll be back to hear from you as we open up the phones for the first time this week. And the Sox take on the Blue Jays tonight. This will be game three of the four-game series and game two of the day-night doubleheader we have today. Coverage of game two begins at 6:07, first pitch at 7:07. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV.
Let our staff at the Warren Store ease you back into a pre-pandemic lifestyle. We can cater your postponed events and even bake you a custom cake. We can dress you in comfortable casual clothing. Make it a day trip for the best one-stop shopping in Vermont. Have lunch on our deck, head upstairs for some much-needed retail therapy, then treat yourself to a specialty coffee from our new espresso machine. You can pick up a colorful Warren Store beach towel for a dip in the river, and how about a delicious house-made ice cream sandwich? Fun, funky, safe, and friendly. Warren Store, Main Street, Warren Village, and warrenstore.com.
This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV, and the phones are open for the first time since last Thursday. So if there's something you've been wanting to tell me, to scold me for, or to give me as a homework assignment, now's the time. 244-1777, 877-291-8255. You can also email vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. When we opened them up last week, you all were sharing some great places around the state to visit, including renting Rudyard Kipling's home down in Dumbarton or seeing the Calvin Coolidge Historic Site in Plymouth Notch. I have tried to get someone on from the Coolidge site to talk about the place and about Silent Cal, but so far to no avail. If you know anyone there, send them my way, please. And to call in now, 244-1777, 877-291-8255. One thing I have been taking note of are some of the clever Vermont vanity license plates that I've been passing. I did pass a Prius the other day, and it had the Vermont plate, "Less Gas." For a Prius. I thought that was brilliant. Well done. I'm not sure I'd pay that extra, whatever it is, $100 a year or something to have that vanity plate. But, you know, send in a message. I'm using less gas. I'm driving my Prius. I just caught a glimpse of one that was getting off exit 15 of I-89, and it read LV to jump. Now, it's either live or love to jump. And I was dying to catch up to the woman driving that car to hear the full story of what kind of jumping she does. Maybe she's, you know, rappelling off cliffs or loves to get on the trampoline. I'm not sure. A pogo a stick person, like we've got Fred the pogo guy. Pogo Fred coming to the Festival of Fools in Burlington this weekend. But Live or Love to Jump is one that I just saw recently. And then this one I got pretty excited for. Passing me on I-89 one day, I saw SRB1 fan. And so SRB1 fan, you know, you try to figure him out, right? And that's the whole thing that's kind of fun about some of these vanity plates. As it drove off, I kept trying to decipher SRB, SRB, and it was a Vermont plate. And finally, it hit me. Starline Rhythm Boys, number one fan, drove by me. So Billy Bratcher, I know he'd be so proud, probably knows the owner of the SRB1 fan car. But I thought that was pretty cool. All right, so here's another thing I'll throw out to you. You know, what would be your vanity plate? Or do you have one that's really quite clever? Let us know at 244-1777, 877-291-8255. That's 877-291-TALK. So you can take it, of course, wherever you like, open phones as well. You don't have to answer one of these questions. The parameters on open phones are they are quite open. And we have, I'd say, about half the time people just calling in with whatever they would like to talk about. So, again, 244-1777, 877-291-8255. Now, one other thing I saw on the highway just a couple days ago, the most illogical, truck company. It was a company that was Igloo something, right? And I think they made something that kept places cold. I don't think it was the Igloo coolers, but Igloo was the main name of this company. Their logo and pictures on the side of this tractor trailer, of this semi, of a company called Igloo, were penguins. Anybody? It's an igloo, which is in the Inuit area of the world, which would be in North America, right, in the Arctic. Penguins only exist in the southern hemisphere. There are no penguins around igloos. So I thought, didn't somebody somewhere bring it up to him? Am I wrong about this? I mean, somebody who knows more than I do, please let me correct me. But I don't think you're going to see penguins hanging around igloos unless you fly a few penguins up to the Arctic and in like Alaska or the Canadian North. This does not happen. So a company named Igloo should not have penguins as their logo. I could be wrong, but I guess I'm just too logical sometimes. It's probably why when I started reading the Choose Your Own Adventure books, it took me a little while to kind of get engaged, because you have to think about books and suspend what you know about reading and not question things, just go along with it a little bit more than I do sometimes. All right. We're at 244-1777, 877-291-8255. And, the open phones are now open mic, because I have here with me, Kaya. What's up?
Well, I heard you about the vanity plates.
Yes.
Which made me think I don't have a vanity plate, but and this sort of may go along with it. You know, when you do your online banking, you can call your accounts. You can give them nicknames.
Right.
So I'm in the bank the other day, and the woman said, well, there's not enough money in that account to withdraw from. And I said, well, and she said, but I can see the names that you've given your accounts. And one of mine is, it's mine, it's mine, it's all my money. And I thought, oh, yeah. Is it that, means something
is that
to
the
me,
one that
but...
didn't have enough?
Yeah. So you have to be careful what you name your bank accounts because the tellers can see it.
No.
And I thought, am I going to have to explain to her why I've labeled it? It's all mine.
It's all mine is not going to fit on a vanity plate, but I wish it would because I'd buy that one for you. Thank you, Kaya. That was gold. All right. Yeah. Be careful what you name things because they might, you might have, just like, what you use as a password, sometimes, you know, somebody says, well, just give me your password and you're going to have to say it out loud. You might want to make sure, that whatever you do, use for a nickname or a password that you can actually, say in public sometime. All right. We're at 244-1777, 877-291-8255 with open phones and now open mics. If you're even like on Stowe Street, you can just stop in the studio now and, stop in here and throw on the headphones and, get in front of the mic and tell me what you want to tell me. Also, of course, it keeps me from talking for, the whole half hour. All right. We're going to go to a break and then come back with open phones. We have until 10:30, getting your favorite, vanity plates in Vermont, and where you take your incoming tourists, anything like that. Join us at 244-1777, 877-291-8255. Let's get Cindy on before we go to the break. She just called in from North Facetown. Cindy, what's going on? How you doing?
Hello. Hi, yes, hi, Rick. I am calling about because my son's birthday is tomorrow,
mm-hmm.
and I can't figure out what to get for him. I called the dude that had this thing on at the Trading Post this morning. I don't know, it's a tree fort.
And
and I called him, but he had already sold it, like, on Saturday.
Oh.
So, but anyway, I thought, oh, that'd be cool. And then I thought, well, maybe I got this thing about the Festival of Fools. And I thought maybe I would take him up to that. And I didn't know what, how you go about doing that.
Okay.
Or where are we?
All right, so Festival of Fools, and if you go to vtfools.com, I think.
Computer.
Okay, that's all right. It's all weekend, and it's all free, which is kind of great.
Yeah.
And so it'll be right there on Church Street in Burlington.
Okay.
And so it gets started on Friday, probably around mid-afternoon is when it'll really start to heat up.
Cool.
Into the evening, and then Saturday and Sunday. So Saturday, I think, you know, around noon, same thing Sunday, goes a little later on Saturday. Yeah, and, you know, you can go up, you can have a nice lunch, and just wander around. There's going to be great music. There'll be, you know, busking going on. And then as you're walking up and down Church Street, every hour there's some kooky thing going on, like Pogo Fred and, you know, different things. So
the cowboy lady and the guy, I don't know. Did you say that he unweaves a tennis racket and puts himself through it?
There's a guy who does that, yes. Alakazam. So do you have last week's 7 days handy?
Yes.
I think they do have in there. I think that's where I found it. There is a book, you know, kind of an insert that
sure.
does give you all the information about it. But I think I have one here at the station. I can always leave it with Kaya downstairs if you can get into Waterbury.
Well, I just might, yes.
All right. Cindy, enjoy.
I will. Yeah, okay.
All right, take care.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
All right, bye-bye. We got Farmer Dave. Farmer Dave, what's going on?
Well, let's talk vanity plates.
Okay.
Years ago, my wife got me a vanity plate, Farmer D. Now, I'm not vain enough to have a vanity plate, but the problem with the plate is not only have I been a farmer for years, but I've been a machinist for years, so precision measurement and spacing of the letters you know.
So yeah.
The problem being, the plate reads, well, it's F armored is what it is. There's a space between the F and the A.
I wondered where they were going to put the space.
Okay, so I go up to motor vehicles, and I'm trying to explain this to them that the spacing's off. And they're telling me that, no, there's only so much space, and I even bring the plate up and I show them. So I'm driving around the parking lot afterwards, and I'm looking because are there any other vehicles, any other letters that have this issue?
Yeah,
anything's got an F, and any other letter is fine. But if it's got an A, I don't know if I can even say this on the radio. They seem to have problems with their F and A's. And that's my story.
I love it, Farmer Dave. Thanks so much. Or should as people who saw you, F armored, it's great to hear from you. All right. And that is a problem. Yeah, the spacing. And I guess it's just the way, I think, do they call it kerning or something? It's just the way the F and the A line up. And Farmer D became F armored, which was more, a nod to his machinery background. Okay. Stephen joins us now from Montgomery. Stephen, you go right ahead.
Hi, Rick. I just want to mention a place to go.
Yeah.
To take visitors.
Mm-hmm.
And that would be the North Branch Cascades on the North Branch of the Winooski, which is on Route 12 between Worcester and Elmore. And there are three parking lots. And there's it's a mile trail each way, handicap perfect. Accessible for the most part, and lots of little stone stairs down to the river. Lots of places to swim, lots of places to take dogs, two composting outhouses, an old farmhouse with a old chimney. And it's a very, very interesting. And there are lots of benches and picnic tables. And I just want to recommend that as a place for people to go who might want to see something really special.
Oh, I love that. North Branch Cascades on Route 12 between Worcester and Elmore. And I love, you know, there's a little bit of a hike, but not much. And like you said, pretty much accessible. So a 1 mile trail each way and then steps downward. Stephen, that's a great suggestion. Thanks so much. I might need to pop out there after work someday. Not far from where we are, so that would be kind of nice. And then I'd head up to East Hardwick for the to go out to Whitefield Hop Yard, get a nice taste of the or smell of those hops, and head over to Whirligig. They should be open by then in St. Jay, and I could try some of their beer. So I would take care of everything in one show. See how informative we can be. All right, on to Barrytown we go, and it's Jim. Hi, Jim. What's going on?
Hey, how are you, Rick?
Good. How you doing?
Hey, a buddy of mine does a Santa Claus gig every Christmas,
mm-hmm.
and he's got the real hair, gray beard, everything, wears glasses.
Mm-hmm.
And so he does these performances. So a couple years ago, he applied for a vanity plate that says Santa. And we were talking about it, and I'm going, I would be really surprised if somebody doesn't already have it.
Right.
Well, he got it. He has a plate that says Santa. Now, you can imagine wherever he goes, you know, the kids and the parents, you know, they. So during the summer, when somebody, you know, a little kid will come up and go, are you really Santa Claus? He goes, yeah, I take my vacations here in Vermont during the summer.
Oh, I love
so
it.
There's one to look for. He's in the Barry area. You'll never know, but he's got Santa.
Hey, Jim, so there is one in the Burlington area, up in Chittenden County somewhere, and it's either Jesus or Jesus. But
I was just thinking of that.
Yeah.
Did somebody have Jesus.
Yeah, someone does. So, you know, if you were thinking about it, it's been taken. But I was kind of stunned. Now, I didn't pull them over to see if they were indeed Jesus or Jesus.
But. Yeah, right. You could have fun with that one.
You could definitely have fun. I didn't get to see. I was behind them, so I didn't get to see if they had the beard and the, you know, and long hair. But there is, so there's a Santa driving around, and there's a Jesus driving around with Vermont vanity plates. So, yeah, I kind of love those.
That would be something.
Yeah, it would. I hope they don't get in an accident.
Up, what a fun time that would be.
Yeah, no kidding.
So, hey, that's my story.
Hey, what kind of car does Santa drive when he vacations?
It's a Toyota. I don't know what model, but, you know, the four-wheel drive, not a pickup, but like an SUV.
I hope it's red.
No, it's white.
I guess
right.
That's okay.
I think that'll be his next color.
All right, good. You tell him. I said it's got to be red next time.
I'll pass that on.
All right. Thanks, Jim. All right. Oh, I love that. That is great. Yeah, there's Santa in central Vermont. That's where he comes to vacation. Jesus hangs out in Chittenden County. That's according to vanity plates we have seen in Vermont. All right. We have a few more minutes here. 244-1777, 877-291-8255 if you want to get in. So I have thought of a few that I would do. My nationality is Slovak, so Slovak is one I've thought about. I'm also known as the Dirty Mayor. There's a drink named after me, so I would either do Mayor or D-R-T-Y, M-A-Y-O-R. I don't know. That might be too many letters. But I am also a big fan of the White Sox and Red Sox, so either Both Sox or Chai Sox would be one that I would do. I'm going to bet that Both Sox and Red Sox are already taken in Vermont as vanity plates, but who knows. All right, we've got just a little bit more time, and then we are going to hear in the next half hour from Steve Collier, and he is the general counsel for the Agency of Agriculture, Food, and Markets, and we're going to talk about what's been passed in the last session here in Vermont that will affect our farms and food industry. Get to some of the highlights of those bills so y'all do know what they're about. All right, we're at 244-1777, 877-291-8255. Might have time for a sneaker inner. No one corrected me on the Igloo company's truck that had the penguin logo and it is plastered with penguins on the side of the truck. Am I wrong? Penguins are south of the equator. They're in the southern hemisphere. Igloos are in the Arctic, so I'm pretty sure that's incongruous, having those two together, but maybe I should just focus more on driving and not on what I'm seeing. All right, let's get a quick one in. Hurry up. Here we go. Ray, you got about 30, 45 seconds. Go.
All right, my wife's vanity plate is N-H-I-C-K.
N-H-I-C-K.
She's had people ask, she's had people say, what does New Hampshire hick stand for?
WDEV
and
Studios.
My wife says it doesn't stand for New Hampshire hick. It stands for N-Hick, which her first name is Nancy. And it stands for Hickory, and that's how she ended up with it, N-Hick.
All right, I love it. I hope she doesn't get ticketed every time she goes to New Hampshire. Well,
but
done, Ray.
She drives a red SUV.
All right. Oh, well, that's what Santa should be driving. Thanks so much. All right, that's a great one. N-Hick is actually, N-Hick is right. N-H-Hick is wrong. All right, that's it, Mr. McGivigan. Let's close them out, and we're going to go to a break and then come back with Steve Collier from the Agency of Agriculture, Food, and Markets. And coming up today at 11, we have Common Sense Radio with Bill Sayre. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV.
Let our staff at the Warren Store ease you back into a pre-pandemic lifestyle. We can cater your postponed events and even bake you a custom cake. We can dress you in comfortable casual clothing. Make it a day trip for the best one-stop shopping in Vermont. Have lunch on our deck, head upstairs for some much-needed retail therapy, then treat yourself to a specialty coffee from our new espresso machine. You can pick up a colorful Warren Store beach towel for a dip in the river, and how about a delicious house-made ice cream sandwich? Fun, funky, safe, and friendly. Warren Store, Main Street, Warren Village, and warrenstore.com.
This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV. When we look back at the recent biennium of the Vermont legislature, the focus was no doubt on relieving the impacts of the pandemic on Vermonters and Vermont businesses, and with good reason. A lot of time and energy was spent on the distribution of federal funds allotted to the state. But that doesn't mean that's all that was proposed, debated, and passed at the virtual State House earlier this year. And there are a number of bills that got passed that will have an impact on our farms and food producers. Joining us to discuss some of that legislation is Steve Collier. He's the general counsel for the Agency of Agriculture, Food, and Markets. Steve, welcome to Vermont Viewpoint.
Good morning. Thank you so much.
Got to turn your mic on, too, there, Steve. All right.
I'm better now, with it off.
No, the world can hear you now. All right. And listeners, if you want to ask Steve about legislation specific to agriculture, you can give us a call at 244-1777, 877-291-8255, or you can email vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. COVID response and the allocation of federal funds, a major focus of the recent session, as I mentioned. But was the amount of legislation affecting agriculture significantly down from a normal year this year?
You know, I would say no. I would, in fact, say it was the opposite, where it was really significantly maybe an increased focus. It's been such an interesting year, as you noted. The last year, 2020, completely consumed by agricultural COVID response and so many different facets and in spending and in facilitating money and trying to support our farmers and producers who were struggling. This year, that was obviously a focus, and it will remain to be one. But a lot of substantive bills were also passed that are maybe tangentially related to COVID relief, but are more targeting Vermont agriculture generally.
Yeah, generally, what were the key agricultural issues that were addressed in this biennium?
Yeah, so if you don't mind, if I could start by just saying that because farming is our focus, right? And, mm-hmm. and it's what we care passionately about. And I'm fairly new to this position. I've been here for a year and a half. And okay. I like to joke.
Oh, just as the pandemic started.
I like to joke that I started in January of 2020 and I was at work for 2 months before the secretary sent me home. fortunately, he didn't only send me home. But so it's been an amazing year, and I think Vermont has weathered it as well as any state in the country, and we're very fortunate and thankful for that. But we also what has really been interesting to me, relatively new to this arena, is how committed not only state government is to farmers, and not to say that there aren't obstacles, because there are.
Right.
But the commitment is terrific, as it is with the farmers themselves. And you know, the overriding challenges that farmers face with environmental concerns, with low milk prices, with you know potential development, the value of their land being so much higher for development than it is for agricultural production.
Right.
Those are constant challenges. But I think this last year also put into focus a little bit more clearly the importance of what they bring. And the importance of food production, the importance of open lands, the importance of them drawing tourism, the importance of them keeping our state the way that we all love it to be. So what I really love about our relationship with the legislature is that the two committees that we work most closely with, the House Agriculture and Forestry Committee and the Senate Agriculture Committee, are incredibly dedicated to working with us as we are with them. And so while we don't always agree on every issue, we do get things done, and we couldn't without their support. And what's great is when they reach out or we reach out to farmers or to other interested groups, they are so responsive and they make that legislative debate and dialogue constructive and productive. So this year we were able to get to deal with a lot of thorny issues that have been developing over a long time mm-hmm. and to get some resolutions that we think work. And, you know, we always want more, but we were able to make real progress.
Well, speaking of that more, were there any issues that the Agency of Agriculture had wished to have addressed by the legislature that they weren't able to get to this year?
From my perspective, and I don't speak for the agency on this, but from my perspective, the most disappointing issue was the lack of Act 250 reform.
Yeah.
And that's something that the governor has obviously been sort of steadfast about pushing. It's a lot broader than just agriculture, but you know, we believe fervently in the need for some farms, not all farms, but for some farms to be able to diversify and to have that direct consumer-to-farm relationship, to be able to bring people to their farms, to show what they offer, to be able to control their own pricing, to develop their own markets. And one way to do that is with accessory on-farm businesses. So a couple of years ago, we got very important legislation passed to allow that to happen so that towns can't prohibit a farm from having a qualifying accessory on-farm business. But that doesn't negate potential Act 250 review. Mm. And not that I don't mean to denigrate in any way Act 250. It has an important role. But, you know, we also believe that rural economic development is critical and that for farmers to be able to diversify, they need a few less hoops to jump through. So one of the things that we proposed was a one-acre exemption for accessory on-farm development from Act 250 review. So in other words, if a farm wanted to put in a cafe, which they can probably do as an accessory on-farm business, they wouldn't have to go through Act 250 review to be able to do that. And there's already some ways they can do it currently, but they're fairly narrow, and we're trying to broaden that up. We want farms to be economic generators for the rural community. We want every area to be as successful as Chittenden County, and we think farms are a cornerstone to making that happen. So we plan or we hope to introduce or to propose that someone will introduce that legislation again this year. We hope Act 250 will get taken up, and we really want some respite for our farmers who want to do more. It's hard enough to farm, deal with all the water quality regulations, deal with all of the regulations, and start a new, you know, a new part of your business and have to jump through even more hoops. So we're hoping for that kind of progress.
Boy, one that really hits home that has been created, I'm thinking of in Waitsfield on the Von Trapp farm. They now have a nice farm stand. What a wonderful place to go into, and not only their own products, but they bring in other Vermont products. I have bought beer from Southern Vermont that I can't get anywhere else, butters that I'm always looking for, and their cheeses, their meats. So it really is kind of wonderful to have that, and I stop in as often as I can.
And the ripple effects to that are incredible, right? Not only for the communities. I mean, that's one thing. A lot of our small towns have lost their general stores. They've lost, maybe some of them have lost their schools through consolidation or their elementary schools. So for these places, for the rural parts of the state to be constructive and productive and to keep people, to retain people and attract people, they need magnets. And a place like that is a magnet.
Yeah.
If you're thinking about moving to Vermont and you drive through a small community and you love it, but you think, what can I do here? And you have some of those farms that invite you maybe to go cross-country skiing, maybe to go horseback riding, maybe to buy local products. Suddenly there's a base that makes that community vital.
Yeah, that's outstanding. We'll get to the specific acts that were approved after the break, but one more question before we go there. How do you convey changes to the laws, to the farms, to the farmers?
Well, we're very active on our website. We have our secretary is a former news media guru who is constantly putting out information. Several of our divisions have their own newsletters. We also have a publication called AgriView, sort of the traditional publication. We, you know, I think probably better than any secretary ever, it puts out information to the consumers because that's a real focal. And I don't mean to cast aspersions. I'm just saying that's a real, it's very important to our secretary that farmers know what's happening.
Yeah. If Anson Tebbets doesn't know how to get it done, I don't think anybody does. All right. Steve, let's take a look at some of the acts that were passed, and I'll start with, Act 74, which is appropriations, for, I think, things like the agriculture economy and landscape.
Yeah, referred to commonly as the big bill. And that, yeah, that's the one that sort of needs to get through one way or the other every time. And we were, you know, we were very pleased with that, especially in light of the pandemic. And going into the pandemic, if anyone could have imagined that instead of contracting significantly, we would sort of be on pace. And that does not mean that, you know, many, many people haven't suffered, because they have.
Right.
But I think in part because of Governor Scott's leadership and in part because of the federal money that's been available, we have been able to stay on track, and in large part because of Vermonters' willingness to follow the guidelines so that we could continue the economy as productively as possible during this unforeseen and unanticipated event. So considering where we might have been, I think we were absolutely delighted to continue to be able to provide the services that we do. And really notably, we got – so I don't know if you're familiar with the Working Lands Program, but it's a program that's designed to support businesses, farmers, and forestry businesses. And it's designed to keep our lands open and productive. And it gives grants for farms who are innovating, who are eligible for those grants. And for the, both from the big bill and another earlier appropriations bill that passed about maybe a month or two before the big bill, we got $5,594,000 total to give out through the Working Lands Enterprise Fund. And that will all go to businesses in Vermont. As far as I know, that's an unprecedented number, largely financed with the federal ARPA funds, with COVID relief, although I think it's actually coming from the general fund as the legislature worked it out. But that's a big injection, we hope, to our farmers to continue to innovate and continue to be successful.
And those grants, those working lands funds, who do they go to? How do people apply? What's that all about?
So the Working Lands Enterprise Board is responsible for administering the grants. We're on that board. Our staff people are intimately involved in setting up those grant programs. They're being constructed now. There is a minimum of $500,000 needs to go to meat slaughter and processing and or training, because we discovered during the pandemic just how important, or rediscovered, I should say, how important those businesses are, and that we need greater local capacity. So the legislature specifically targeted $500,000 at least of those funds. So we know at least $500,000 will go to meat processing or slaughter, and maybe more. I think it will depend upon the projects. But those will be advertised by us once they're established. We're working on that. The board has to decide the guidelines and the grant guidelines, but that's something that people can look forward to seeing in the near future.
Outstanding. The slaughter facility is definitely something we've talked about on this show. And as the national supply chain really slowed down, and even more than ever, Vermonters look to farmers for their food here in Vermont, that was really an issue. I want to talk about Act 31, which is limiting liability for agritourism. This sounds like a really positive bill for our farmers. Why was this necessary?
Well, so
and what does it do? I guess you should probably explain more of that.
No, absolutely. I mean, this is exciting, and it kind of harkens back to what I was talking about the importance of farms diversifying, bringing people to the farm, sharing what they have, the amazing things that they have. You know, farmers know what it's like to live on a farm. Only about 2% of U.S. residents now have ever farmed. So when you think about that, to be able to share those experiences, to encourage new people, we need new farmers. You know, we want people on the farm. But farmers involve very dangerous activities, right? So so people who farm know that. People who farm know how to avoid them to the best extent possible. But what this does is it allows farmers to more easily welcome people to their farms without bearing the associated risks. So this does not mean that farmers shouldn't be careful,
right?
Because if someone's hurt, it's a problem, and it might be yours. But what it does is it recognizes legally that there are inherent risks associated with agricultural activities. And what it does is it transfers those inherent risks to the informed consumer. So instead of the farmer being responsible for the inherent risks of being on a farm, the consumer can either elect to take that risk or not. That's pretty unusual in the law to transfer a risk like that. The law used to be more like that, about assumption of risk, but it's sort of molded away from that. And this is a very affirmative step where if a consumer wants to participate in these recreational or educational activities on farms, they are the ones who are going to assume the risk of getting hurt, provided, and this is very important, farms have to warn the consumers of this risk. The risk can't be transferred unless farms very clearly and explicitly post a sign at the entrance to any agritourism activity, and that sign is expressly articulated in statute. It's got to be exact. It's got to be a certain size. It's got to be there. But if they do that and they include that language in any contract that they have with their consumers, then they are protected from those inherent risks should the unfortunate happen and someone become injured. So it's a big deal in terms of making giving greater flexibility for farms to welcome people to their farms.
All right. Act 47 is one that talks about the food supply in times of emergency and food insecurity. What is happening in this and how will this be accomplished?
Sure. So that's our that was in our housekeeping bill, or what we call our housekeeping bill. And there were, I think, 11 different items that were passed in that bill. And all of them are important for their individual constituency. Most of them are probably not that interesting to your general audience. But the emergency food management planning was interesting, and that arose from the pandemic with a recognition that having local food available is very important.
Yeah.
So as part of our emergency planning, we were tasked with coordinating with others to evaluate how can we do more to ensure to the best extent possible that local food will be available should we need it in an emergency. So that was important. Another important thing for hemp growers is that the law was changed so that we could stay under the 2014 Farm Bill. And the reason that's important is when hemp was first legalized in 2014, the THC threshold was set. And
right.
It's 0.3%. I won't get too into the weeds here because it's confusing. But in 2018, it was reestablished to a much stricter standard. And we continue to operate under the 2014 standard because otherwise about 40% of our crop would have to be destroyed because it wouldn't meet the new threshold. So this was changing state law to allow us to continue under the 2014 federal program. We're hoping for longer term solutions, but this is the current solution that we have.
I know one that people will be very interested in is Act 22, which has to do with raw milk. And I believe, I don't know exactly what this changes, but I think it does allow for more raw milk to be sold by farmers directly to consumers.
You're absolutely right. So under the pre-existing law, farmers could only sell raw milk directly to consumers or through farmers markets. This expanded that ability to sell somewhat to allow them to sell through CSAs and also through farm stands. So it does expand the ability to sell raw milk while also maintaining some controls. And raw milk I could talk about for a long time because it's fascinating.
Yeah.
And, you know, I don't know that we have time to do it right now, or if you want to get into it a little bit or not.
Well, let's try to get a call in. We've got 2 minutes left, but that is Act 22, and people can learn more about this at the Ag Agency's website. Let's get Karen in from Hardwick really quick. Karen, go right ahead.
Hi. We're a working dairy farm. Our barn is in poor shape. Do you have any programs coming that would help us fix it?
Thanks, Karen.
So, hi, Karen. That is a terrific question, and I do not know about how all of our different programs, and the Agency of Agriculture has some. There's also money through ACCD, which is the Agency of Commerce Community Development, also through Vermont Housing and Conservation Board. I'm not aware of a current program that we have to fix barns. We do anticipate that ARPA, which is the federal funds, are going to be dedicated to infrastructure. I don't know whether an individual barn would qualify, and I doubt it from what I know so far. But I don't know. I don't have a great answer for you right now. There are people at our agency, including in our agricultural development division, and Abby Willard is our director, who might be a good person for you to contact and talk to. And she would have a better sense of exactly what programs may or may not be available for you.
All right, Karen, please reach out to Abby Willard and the agency to learn more, because if there are funds, we definitely want you to know about that. Steve, we're out of time. Steve Collier is the general counsel for the Agency of Agriculture, Food, and Markets. And listeners, to learn more about agricultural legislation from the recent biennium, we've kind of just touched on a few of the acts that were approved. You can visit agriculture.vermont.gov. Steve, thanks so much for spending time with us on this subject today.
Thanks so much for taking the time to talk about it.
Sure thing. Vermont Viewpoint is directed by Danny McGivrigan and produced by Rachel Connor, Zoe Helena, and Brad Jalili. Our email address is vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. Please feel free to suggest topics or guests, and you can listen to past episodes of Vermont Viewpoint by downloading our podcast at wdevradio.com. Common Sense Radio with Bill Sayre is up next. I'm Rick Singeri. I'll be back here tomorrow, and I want to let you know that coming up on Friday morning at 9 o'clock, we'll have Representative Peter Welch here on Vermont Viewpoint.